Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
FM Los Angeles 102.3 FM Riverside
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course I'm Al Warren. Today on the co-host chair we've got Mr. John Copenhaver.
Hey Al, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good. Now, today, we are kind of going into newer territory, in a sense. We talked to a lot of writers, we talked to a lot of film people and all this, but today we are talking advanced creative nonfiction, okay? So that's a whole new subject that we haven't covered. So we kind of got the best in the business. We got some people that have been doing this and have written a book called Advanced Creative Nonfiction, A Writer's Guide and Anthology. So let's welcome Mr. Sean Prentice.
Thanks so much for having me, Alan John.
And Jessica Hendry Nelson.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, we're glad you made it. This is quite the category. We were talking about this before, and I know it seems to be one of those areas that's all over the place. I hear all sorts of descriptions and people give me all sorts of meanings, but it's not very one-centered focus from people. I hear all sorts of things. So for a very basic description, what is creative nonfiction?
The shortest sentence I've come up with for creative nonfiction is truth told artfully. So it's just true stories that are told in a way that makes them beautiful in whatever angle we're looking at.
Under that umbrella, you know, one of the reasons that creative nonfiction is so debated and complicated in the marketplace is because it's not so easily definable. So it is a big umbrella term that includes everything from, you know, memoir to journalism, you know, and everything in between, and you know, and even hybrid narratives that, you know, play with notions of truth and fiction, and we call those hybrids sometimes, or we call them lyric essays, are often a cross between an essay and poetry. And so there's just this great big swath. And so I think for Sean and I, when we were conceiving of this book, we thought about creative nonfiction. The way that we think about creative nonfiction is really any narrative that's interested in veracity in a direct way. And that means that ostensibly the author makes a kind of promise to the reader that they are going to tell their narrative as truthfully as possible, while also being beholden to the art of the story.
You know, one thing I thought about and even noticed when I was reading the book was you mentioned memory, and you talk about memory and how it's really kind of it's not always the same each time we call up a memory. Like each time we go back and think about something, we're kind of recreating that memory, is sort of how you put it, I think. And that's an interesting part of it, because so much of truth comes from witness and witness memory, and that includes ourself, of course. So that seems to be a question I have, in the sense of how do we resolve that? How do we know that our memories are correct enough to be, you know, explaining a story?
You know, one of the ways that memory works, and I'm sure Sean can speak to this too, you know, is that every time we call up a particular memory, that memory shifts. And so, you know, antithetical to logic, some of our most pristine memories, so to speak, are those that we don't actually remember all that often. And, you know, as we move through our lives, those experiences, those memories change tenor, they change shape, they change meaning, because we need them to mean something different. You know, we need them to fit into this narrative of who we are and how we got to be. And so that just naturally happens in the brain. And so you can think of the, you know, memory itself as its own kind of creative nonfiction. And so, of course, the moment we commit that to the page, then there's this next level of separation from actuality, from event, capital T truth, you know, if such a thing were to actually exist, and the words on the page, you know, the experience for the reader. And so I think part of, you know, writing creative nonfiction is acknowledging that there is no real veracity that we can access, but we can use the slipperiness of memory in order to make meaning. And by that I mean, you know, we can speculate about it. That's one of the great tools that we have as creative nonfiction writers, is to question our own memories and really hold them accountable. And ask, you know, it's not, you know, Brenda Miller, Kim Barnes, one of my favorite writers, says it's not what we remember, but why we remember it, you know, and how we remember it that matters. And that's something that creative nonfiction writers are attuned to.
Yeah, and maybe what I'll add here is just a little bit more of the science to all this. So, Al, back to your idea of memory, the one thing we can promise you, at least from what we know about the brain, is that memory is broken. And that's not a bad thing. It's a beautiful thing. It's how all of our brains work. Number one, we have the forgetting curve. So we forget about 80% of the bigger things that we experience in any given moment. And we lose that those memories within, say, a week. And then the other thing is eyewitness accounts are wrong about 50% of the time. This is even when the eyewitness is really, really focused on details. Obviously we're on Zoom right now, and I get a picture of John's face right here. So even if I study and study and study John's face, I still have a 50% chance of getting it wrong, even if I'm trying to get it right. And then the final thing, like you and Jess were talking about, the brain literally wipes out old memories and recreates them anytime we remember anything. So each time it's like a distorting the memory. So the four of us are going to have four different memories, and they're going to grow further and further different. Nevertheless, true to ourselves, but maybe more and more untrue to what Kant would call the noumenal world, or the exact world, or the real world.
It's interesting because I have, you know, photographs and albums, and I have come to realize that, in fact, I don't have a memory of the event, but I have a memory of looking at the photo, and somehow in my mind I've conflated the two. And I mean, is that sort of, if people have that kind of experience, is that sort of what you're talking about here?
Yeah, I think that that's exactly what happens. You guys have had maybe similar experiences where, you know, you've been told a story so often and you can't remember if you were there for that experience, or it was just something, you know, your mother told you happened
right.
50 times. I had that experience recently where, you know, I was relating this memory to my mother about driving my little brother when he was 3 to the hospital. And I was, all of the details were so vivid. In fact, I'd even written these details into my first book. And I get done my whole little diatribe, and she says, but you weren't even there, Jess. And it was so alive for me. And I think, you know, if I were to write that experience now, I would have to account for that. So I think that's part of the contract that you make with the reader is, I wouldn't write it the same way. You know, in my first book, I wrote it as if I were there because that's what I believed happened. But if I were to write that today, I would have to wrestle with the experience, but also why I feel like I was there. And I think it's part because I was told the story so often, and part just, you know, the kind of emotional connection I have to the memory because, you know, my brother was so sick and I remember being so concerned. And it's, you know, it's probably somewhere in that gray area that we come to hold these memories in the way that we do at some point.
But I wonder when these things happen and when we go to write them, put them down in the book or in paper, we're not really doing it consciously. We're not selecting to do this that way. We're not selecting to make it fit our narrative today as we're writing, at least not that we know of. So we really believe what we're writing is true. How do you validate that?
Well, for me, I wrestled with this for a long time. And there's, like we were talking about before the podcast, there's all this debate going on about what creative nonfiction and what truth is and all of that. And for me, rather than seeing it as problematic, I see it as beautiful. We have flawed memories, and that's just who we are. And we're also narrative, you know, animals. We need to create narrative to make our way through the world. And I would guess that there really is no narrative to our lives. We're just living our lives bouncing into things. But we put meaning on it. We put narrative on it. And then we put that on the page. And that's one of a million stories that we could tell. And we've just decided to see ourselves as brave or cowards or happy or sad, as in love or out of love. And we just impose that narrative on it. And sometimes we do it overtly, and that might be a little heavy-handed. But I think we all do it all the time, creating a narrative as a way to survive in this world.
I've been writing a lot of true crime nonfiction for quite a while. And one thing I've learned was that whenever you're out in the field and you're speaking to people and you're speaking to them about a particular subject or a person, every witness, so to speak, that I talk to has a totally different perspective of that subject we're talking about or that person, suspect. And they tell you a completely different, you couldn't match some of their descriptions as being the same event around the same person. And so that leads me to the next section when we talk about the creative research with nonfiction writers, like because we're relying on I guess subject matter that is outside of our own personal experience. I didn't see the accident or the murder, and I didn't know the person or the suspect. So I'm relying on other people's points of views, and yet I've noticed that they can be so, so different.
You know, under that umbrella of creative nonfiction, I would say true crime is under that umbrella, and you as the storyteller have all kinds of bias, you come to conclusions, and, you know, probably, I would suspect that part of your process is to try to repress those as much as possible, or to be beholden to as objective a truth as you can manage, and yet, you know, we're all human beings with opinions and feelings, and so it's really impossible, but you're beholden to truth, to a kind of veracity that maybe the memoirist isn't quite beholden to, because these are serious crimes and serious implications, and a true crime narrative has different standards and expectations. You know, the reader comes to it with a different sort of expectation. And so when you do that research, I wonder, do you invite in all of those varied perspectives from the various witnesses? Do you allow those to hold equal weight on the page?
Well, I don't. one of the biggest problems with my own personal writing is that quite a bit of the feeling that I get from people, when people are describing things, I try not to let the emotion, and sometimes it gets in on the first drafts. Like, you put quite a few of the thoughts and memories from people in, but the bottom line is, at the end of the book, people have got to understand what happened, where it happened, and why, as best as can be told. So those opinions from a lot of the people involved will get in the way of the story. So I've got to kind of keep them held back somewhat. So I try not to let it get too much in the middle of it. And I try not to have conclusions either. I try not to say, this is, you know, what I think. I might have opinions, but I'm trying not to put that in there.
And Al, one thing I'm thinking about with all this is there's an art restoration term called Tritigio. It's probably said with a much more Italian accent than I can pull off. But let's imagine we have a painting and it gets some flood damage, some water damage, and parts of it bubble up and parts of it fall away. We can restore it in a variety of ways. One is, we can hire an artist who's an expert in this style to come in and repaint it so it looks brand new. And that, to me, is not necessarily true. The art is a kind of a living thing, and it's been damaged. So now if we make it look pristine again, we've kind of changed its natural trajectory. And what Tritigio says is, what we can do is kind of sketch in what used to be there, so you can kind of get the idea. You can see the rest of the nose or the eye and the way it's slanted. But it's done, say, in pencil rather than in paint. So it's really clear to the reader that something is missing here, and it's being sketched in. And I kind of see that as what we're talking about here, where when all these different ideas come together, they don't come together into a perfect image when you're talking about a true crime. Instead, what they come in is like a shattered window. We're trying to put it back together. We say, well, it's back together, but it's looking very different. So, I think that's the beauty of it all, is when we rebuild it, we show the flaws, the holes, the things we couldn't uncover, the overlapping areas, the contradictions. And to me, that's what makes all of this most beautiful, is it's not as pristine as a perfect truth.
I guess it's just the point of view of how you tell it. I guess that's what it's, that's what it is, you know, because I could take, like Sean, I could take you, and I could talk to people that know you from different parts of your life, and I can say to them, describe what kind of a person that Sean is. Tell us, could he have killed that person, or whatever the thing is we're talking about? And it's amazing the variety of answers you'll get, because they've only known one part of you, and they've only seen one part of you in a certain light, in a certain place, at a certain time. And so all of that comes into play. And then again, we talk about, how is it that they're going to remember this when they think back? Well, he was, you know, I knew him 10 years ago and stuff. So that's kind of the hardest thing you deal with in my kind of writing. But, you know, I guess that goes to, you have to connect with your reader by displaying things of the time, at the time that you're writing.
Keep on thinking as we're talking about, probably the most famous true crime novel, well, invented true crime, In Cold Blood. And I think I personally would categorize this creative nonfiction, because, Capote pulled a lot of it. I mean, he didn't take great notes, and he claimed to have sort of a superb, if not photographic, memory. I guess I have a little doubt about that, but it had such impact as a book, you know. And so I keep on thinking about, to what degree, how do I put this, do we need to fuse things together so that they really have an impact. Like, you know, how do we tell these stories, important stories? I don't know, I'd be curious what you guys thought about that. To what degree does fiction or fictional methods play into something like creative nonfiction?
Well, I think in the case of Capote, a lot. I mean, I think that's a big part of, you know, what we've learned about that book over the years is how much fiction, you know, is involved in it. But fiction is, of course, the being beholden to a kind of capital T truth is a misconception. And so, you know, what Capote made was a really beautiful, compelling, nuanced story. And that story has its roots in truth, in true experience. I think Capote would probably have been taken to task by Oprah today if the book had come out now, in the way that, you know, James Fry was in A Million Little Pieces. But, you know, there are all sorts of approaches to this question of truth and veracity as it relates to creative nonfiction. And, you know, someone like David Shields, who wrote a book called Reality Hunger about, must have been almost a decade ago now, you know, he's someone who is really prominent in the field of creative nonfiction and wrote this book called Reality Hunger, in which he essentially argues that there is no distinction between fiction and nonfiction. And, you know, the only compelling or even true stories are those that allow the distinctions to evaporate. So much so that he will quote joyfully and prolifically from other sources and won't cite them, you know, and won't want to, because he, you know, his argument is that language is open source. And in the case of Reality Hunger, of course, they made him index at the back of the book, but he even encourages you, as you're, you know, in the introduction, not to look at those sources. So, and that's, you know, an extreme end. And I think that there's an interesting and compelling argument to be made there that, you know, the minute you commit something to page, you know, you are turning it into an artifice. It's art, it's artifice, it's a construction. And, you know, the more we embrace that and acknowledge that, then, you know, the better able we are to move on into, I guess, I don't know, in some ways a more honest approach or process. And then, of course, you have journalists on the way other end of the spectrum who feel like that's absolute baloney and that everything can be fact-checked. And then, of course, there's this great spectrum in between. And I think every writer, every reader has to negotiate that relationship, and especially creative nonfiction writers. I think we're always renegotiating that relationship. We talk a lot about aesthetic truth or emotional truth in my creative nonfiction classes, for example. And students will get into debates about how much creative license is okay. And that can range anywhere from, you know, the color of the shirt so-and-so is wearing, to the dialogue, to the weather, to details, to, you know, composite characters. And people fall all along that spectrum. You know I have my personal contract that feels ethical to me and creatively interesting to me, but that's very personal and it evolves. And so I think that's what makes it tricky for a lot of readers, you know, is to enter that slippery territory and be comfortable wading through it.
You talk a lot about the situation of the reader and how it's simpler to discover and share with the reader than the central question, you know, of our writing. Can you maybe explain what you mean by that?
The basic idea with the situation is the who, what, where, and when. And Al, as you were mentioning earlier, sometimes you're going to get differences of opinions. But for the most part, we can say where this true crime occurred. We could talk about when it occurred, even if it's kind of a vague, you know, 12 hours or 2 hours. Who we could say, you know, was, this is, you know, who had the the crime perpetrated on them, and we don't know who did it, but you know, maybe we have a height or something, so we can get basics there. So the who, what, where, and when is the situation. And again, that's the basics, and that just grounds the reader. But if we have all those details, all we have is just those grounding details. We don't have a story. And the central question is why we're obsessing over this, what we want to figure out about this, why we want to unravel this true crime mystery versus any others, what makes it unique, what makes it weird, how does it connect to anything else? So that would be the central question. That's a much harder one for the writer to figure out. And then it's a much more delicate balance for weaving through your story so that when they get to the end and they find out who or, did it, or maybe we never find that out, they don't just get an answer. What they get is a mood, a feeling, a tone, an idea. And that might be called the knot of meaning. And it just pulls the whole book together. And when you're done, you set down the book and you just have to think for a little bit and just reflect and re-understand your world in relationship to this book. So that's kind of the idea between the situation and the story or the central question.
That knot of meaning, too, just to build on that a little bit, is always embracing contradictory or ancillary truths. You know, that it's not a single truth. So there's the, in true crime, you know, if we discover who the killer was, that's one truth. But the deeper mystery of that story.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Probably has much more to do with motive, with complicated dynamics and relationships and emotions and lust and rage and fear and all of that. And so, you know, the best true crime, I think, whether we discover whether, you know, who the killer is or not, we're left with a complicated emotional truth that we have to wrestle with, and that doesn't necessarily resolve into, you know, killer equals bad guy, victim equals innocent. You know, that there's something much more nuanced under the surface there.
And I guess you would use the forms of your writing to to present that, right? Whether you're doing it as a, I know some of your categories, how you will do it as a collage, let's say, as compared to braid it. So they're kind of different. What do you think? Do you have a, I don't want to say best way, but what do you think is the, what would be the best way to form out your story?
I think for me, you have to know your story to figure out what it needs. And you also have to know yourself. You were talking, if you interviewed a whole bunch of people about me, you'd get a kind of a collage. But what I've found is different people write in different ways. And Jess and I are good examples of that. I think I'm more tied to chronology because it's just how my brain works. A cause B cause C. So I stick to that more often. And I think Jess might say that she uses chronology a lot less than I do. And there's not a right or a wrong. It's how does the story unfold in your mind? How does it make sense to you? And then how can you present it to the reader in a way that'll make sense to them? And there's a whole gamut. You know, the braided essay is going to take three different storylines. Maybe our killer as a kid, our killer as a middle-aged person, and our killer on death row. And it's going to weave those three together, and we're going to get, you know, early, middle, late, early, middle, late. And then at some end point, it all comes together. The collage might take those same three and then just break them all apart and then add a whole bunch of other stuff, maybe snippets of the cities where they live, maybe the victims, and just kind of toss them all around and see what happens if we play with all of these and what moods and emotions we get. Chronological would just take us beginning to end. He started out at this age, and then he went to this age, and then he ended up at this age. The lyric might just, you know, focus on an idea or a tone or an image or sound or something like that. So I would say listen to the story and listen to yourself. Jess, what do you think?
I think every story finds its form, and I think you find that form through chasing that central question. So if I'm writing about a particular experience in my childhood, for example, as I continue to draft that essay, the real question, the deeper question that I'm asking in the essay starts to present itself. I start to figure that out. And, you know, through the drafting process, you start to also discover, you know, which form is going to be the most conducive to the complicated truths that you're trying to unpack. So, you know, there's an argument to be made, say, for example, if we're, you know, writing a true crime book, for moving back and forth between, you know, the murderer's adulthood and their childhood, because the writer's really interested in the influence that that particular childhood had on his behavior later on. And so, you know, one way that you could highlight that is to move really deliberately through those two time periods, you know, and find interesting juxtapositions where cause and effect becomes, you know, more apparent. Or, you know, the knot of meaning reveals, to say something more like there was no cause and effect. And that's one of the, or not, you know, no cause and effect that we can discern. And so, you know, how do you find a form that's going to best support that idea? So it's a really fluid, it's a fluid process, and it's part of the puzzle making that I think, you know, I always think of creative nonfiction as solving a puzzle in some ways. And that puzzle is geared toward this knot of meaning, these contradictory truths that are equally true, and you ask the reader to hold them as equally true in the same breath.
It's very interesting. I think that, I mean, as a mystery writer, I'm very, drawn to both the gesture to kind of fit pieces together, and then I think a suspicion of doing that too neatly, you know? Right. And I feel like in a lot of ways, creative nonfiction, it does something similar as well. And then, you know, it's interesting to think about the pairing of true crime with creative nonfiction as being a really, you know, exciting and interesting one. So I have a question for you, like in terms of outfacing, and because, you know, I think in a lot of ways, something like creative nonfiction is playing in the space of, you know, ambiguity and a willingness to sort of be okay with a lack of resolution. But I feel like the marketplace often doesn't like to sell that. And how do you sort of, which is a shame. I hope that changes. But how do you navigate that? I mean, you know, when people come to your books, like how would you sort of, how do you place yourself within the market? I just think it's a fascinating question.
That is a fascinating question. And I wish I had the answer to that. it's, you know, there's a market, there's certainly, yeah, there's not going to be a kind of huge readership necessarily for more subtle writing that is irresolvable. Part of it is the market of the publishing industry, the appetite of readers who are used to, you know, narratives that resolve in tidier ways. You know, the experience of writing from life is such that the life isn't over. And so, you know, the nature of the work is, it takes as its premise that it's irresolved. There are ways, of course, to create a sense of resolution or a sense of feeling like the narrative arc of the project has fulfilled its own aims. And that's different than resolution. But, you know, on a more practical level, it means that often, you know, you publish with, you know, more smaller indie presses with, you know, editors and readers who are more interested in that kind of work.
And this maybe goes back to the last question on like how to build a story. And it might just be, what story do you want to build? And you could build one that is easy to mass market, and then it might require less complexity, so it can reach a bigger audience. Or you might want one that's more complex, and then you just accept that you're probably going to have a smaller market. And then you can, you know, you can guide yourself. What's your aim? And then you head towards that.
That's fine. I mean, it's, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with wanting resolution. You know, we all want resolution. You know, the reason we turn to stories, I think, is in part because we like the way that narrative brings a kind of coherence to what is otherwise chaos. And so that's very comforting. And I turn to stories with resolutions for the same reason. So, you know, I think for every reader, there's, you know, just in the same way that we all sort of enjoy art from lots of different perspectives and styles, you know, so too do readers, hopefully.
I think that I particularly in this time with COVID and everything else going on, that, you know, people, interestingly enough, I think kind of hunger for both. I don't know if you guys agree, but that comfort of resolution, but also, you know, something at looking at the world that might, you know, be addressing the fact that there's not an easy resolution. Have you encountered any of that in your, you know, writing or thinking?
Funny you mention that, because I've been, you know, I'm primarily a creative nonfiction writer, and I read a lot of creative nonfiction because that's what I love. And I love, you know, art that's made out of direct experience. I just find that infinitely interesting. But in COVID, I found myself increasingly going back to novels. And maybe there's something in that, you know, that impulse to return to a story that feels at the very least put to bed, right? The fiction story is created, it's written, and it's you know, more or less resolved, and it's done. Whereas in nonfiction, you know, the writer's life, the speaker's life, the narrator's life continues in all of its complicated glory, and as do ours. And so, yeah, maybe there is something about COVID feeling like we need to return to a place of resolution. I don't know. What about you, Sean?
Yeah, I would think the more tired I get, the more I want resolution. And it feels like springtime is budding here in Vermont. We had reached up into the 40s today, and it felt hopeful for the first time in a long time. So I sat outside. I read a section of a poetry, and it seems like, you know, when I'm in a better space, I'm able to deal with complexity more. But yeah, through much of this, I want nice, simple things that are resolved nice and easily.
Well, there you go. It was 57 in Canada. So, you know, I'm wearing shorts now, so come on. You know, things are looking up. When I released a couple of books a while ago, I almost put them as historical fiction, and I think that's kind of what I was thinking, because there's a certain amount of unreliable information out on a case that's 100 years old. But there's people that won't, you know, then they think that it's all made up. It's a really tough thing, and then there's so much speculative fiction on right now, and I don't even really understand what they mean when they say speculative fiction.
Well, I think I have at least one description. This book came out of a series, and we're proposing a book on speculative fiction. And I believe the idea is, taking oftentimes the world as it is, and then let's speculate on one little thing. What if all trees died? Or what if the sky changed colors? Or what if gravity decreased by 20%? So we're speculating on these little tiny, theoretically tiny changes and what they would cause. So I think that's, you know, maybe a broad definition of what speculative fiction is. But the other thing I'm thinking about with that historical novel idea is that I'm thinking about Negro League baseball. And for a century or more, all the Negro League baseball players were outcasts. They just were not considered part of really modern baseball at all. And all these historians went back and they scoured the, you know, all the databases they could, newspapers, radio shows, anything they can get their hands on. And they pieced together the careers of these baseball players whose careers were completely lost. And what we see is they're starting to say, well, we think this player who you've never heard of might have been maybe as good as Babe Ruth. And you have to hem and haw a whole lot. And you have to speculate a whole lot. But if you look at it from this angle, and if you use this sort of methodology, you can see how we can take something really, really old and really hard to uncover and say, well, we think this is the truth, and we might be completely wrong, but it's pretty cool to look at.
Yeah, I think the difficulty I was having is that because publishers will put you in that category, and then there's the other books that are saying, well, Hitler escaped, or you know, they start putting in a lot of things that it's almost conspiracy.
Well, I would say put yourself in the true crime, even though it's so old. As long as you're doing your research and you're doing it well, you're allowed to speculate on what you believe the truth was. And you know, if you're doing your job well, call it creative nonfiction, call it true crime.
My understanding, Sean, sometimes that a writer can acknowledge that they're speculating, you know, they can offer it not as an absolute, but say, this is a possibility, you know, is that another way to handle it?
Yeah, and that would be speculative nonfiction, which is completely different than speculative fiction. And there's a lot of different terms, but I love the use of speculation. We use it every single day. We speculate on the weather. The 10-day forecast says it's going to snow, and then in 10 days it rains. You know, it's not that we were lying. It's that all the data we had pointed one direction, and then those data points changed. And that's, you know, how we survived. We survived via speculation. So we take all that historical data on a true crime. And we say, from this perspective, this is what I think, and I think I'm telling the truth.
So at the end of the day, when someone picks up advanced creative nonfiction, your book, what is it that you hope that they take away? What in a fairly short kind of phrasing, what is it that you want them to take away?
For me, I really want readers and writers to understand how broad the category is and how many craft techniques are available to creative nonfiction writers. That, you know, a lot of people don't know about creative nonfiction, or if they do know about creative nonfiction, they have this very narrow idea about what it is. And my hope is that this book opens them up to the breadth of creative nonfiction and gives them more opportunities to think about craft as, you know, from borrowing from fiction techniques or poetry techniques, with, you know, just as rich a history.
Yeah, I love what Jess said. The big thing is we want to bring people to creative nonfiction and bring creative nonfiction to people and see how it fits their lives, their stories, their memories, their truths.
I think the bottom line on that is that you're saying that creative nonfiction is really for anybody that writes.
I would say creative nonfiction is for everybody. End of story. You do not survive this world without having stories about who you are and how you interact with the world. And those are the way we live in the world is as creative nonfiction beings. We create narratives on how our lives unfold. We create narratives on how we interact with our friends and loved ones and enemies. And then we can choose to write those down and be creative nonfiction writers. But if we don't write them down, we're still doing the exact same thing every day in our lives as a way to survive.
Creative nonfiction is, you know, is in large part, you know, to understand creative nonfiction is to also acknowledge the spectrum of veracity. And I think that's important, you know, just in the way that we move through the world. We're surrounded by creative nonfiction, from our news to our podcasts to our television to our documentaries to, you know, from on and on and on. And, you know, once we understand that and come to terms with that, I think we can wrestle with nuance a little bit better.
Very, very, very interesting subject. Very, very, very good book. Now, of course, now the book we're talking about is Bent's Creative Nonfiction. It's a writer's guide and anthology. It's written by Sean Prentice and Jessica Hendry Nelson. Now, do you guys have a website, or do you guys like to do social media? Where do you like to connect with readers?
We have a website, and the website for the book is, that's where I was hoping you would jump in and tell Al the website address.
I am finding it right now. So if you go to bloomsbury.com and just type in Advanced Creative Nonfiction, they'll take you to their page, and then if you scroll way down, you'll get to our page, which is coming up right now for me. And it's bloomsburyonlineresources.com/advanced-creative-nonfiction. But you could also just email Jess or me. We're both very findable on the internet. Or you can find us via social media and just ask. But our website has a whole bunch of stuff, a whole bunch of terms and definitions, a whole bunch of interviews via podcast, which are authors. Pretty soon we'll have some other stuff up there as well.
Yeah, it will have that link on our site too, so people can find it. Hopefully with one click easier. Why did you guys set out to write this book, actually? And let's start with Sean.
So I set it out because I taught this class when I was at my last university, and I had to cobble together a collection of craft essays to build the book I wanted to teach. And I just realized that we needed something more. We needed one cohesive book for a class like this, for students like this, for writers like this. And I couldn't get it out of my mind. So finally, I decided that this was what I wanted to spend a year doing. And then I asked Jess to be a part of it because, number one, she's brilliant. And number two, she thinks differently than me. And I wanted someone who would really push back against my ideas and you know, offer very different perspectives. And that's what I love about having Jess be a part of this book is I mean, she transformed the book and the ideas we include.
It was an honor to be asked. I think Sean and I, we were colleagues at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. And before that, you know, we had been in a writer's group together. And so we had just, you know, been fortunate enough to have so many great conversations about creative nonfiction. And we shared that frustration of teaching and having every year to, you know, reinvent this text by cobbling together pieces from one textbook and pieces from another and various essays. And when the opportunity arose to put that together into our own sort of scripture, you know, it was hard to pass that up, you know, and I think about craft that way. You know, it's really mutable, and it's, you can individualize it. And I just hadn't found a text, a single text that spoke to all of the ways that I thought about creative nonfiction. And so this was an opportunity to do that in conversation with someone who you know, was equally as thoughtful and smart about it, but also thought very differently. And what a cool opportunity that was.
You know, I noticed that it just came out July 29th of last year. When you were on the working process of this, you know, COVID was kind of in a peak and there was a lot of shutdown and all of the stress going on around. Does that sort of interfere in writing a book like this, or did it give you any new perspectives on creative nonfiction?
Actually, I don't think we wrote any part of the book during COVID, which might just tell you about the long process, at least as far as I can remember. I think we were in the copy editing stage, which went on for a while, but everything was written, I believe, before COVID.
That is true, and thankfully so. I'm very glad that we got the writing part done before COVID. And yeah, it was mostly copy editing and proofreading after that. So that was actually a good way to use the COVID time. It was much more concrete.
Yeah.
The one thing I'll say is we started the book pre-COVID, and I remember Jess and me sitting at a coffee shop table and just like sketching out like how this book would unfold over and over again and getting deep into philosophical discussions about what all this means. And I'm so thankful that we were able to sit there in person and really wrestle through these ideas, because they were mind-numbing.
Yeah, there's a different energy, right, you know, when you're there with someone. Do you think COVID will have an effect on a lot of writing?
And one thing I think about, Al, when you ask that question is, I'm teaching a class right now called Forms of Joy in Creative Nonfiction. And in part, that class was inspired by this, I don't know if you want to call it a pattern, but something I noticed that, you know, that of course in times of real strife, you know, there's a lot of art that comes out of bearing witness to that. But there's also this other thing that happens, which is people react from a place of joy. They insist on it as, I think, probably a means of survival. And so things like, you know, Beethoven's Ode to Joy during the Congress of Vienna, or this book that I'm teaching called, you know, Roskay's Book of Delights, which is a beautiful book of creative nonfiction that came out during the, you know, the Trump era. You know, there's a pattern and a kind of resilience to artists and human beings more generally that responds to these crises with art that is born and interested in facets of joy. And so I suspect there will be art in that vein. But, you know, of course, like any complicated or you know, grief-stricken period, there's also the bearing witness to that and maybe finding, you know, the joy that sustains us in the crafts.
The only thing I would add is that we seem to also be in some place with COVID and politics, where we're really wrestling with what truth is, what fact is, if there is any, and how we can distort it if we want to. And I think that's something that's really interesting about this time as well, and creative nonfiction.
Well, certainly, you know. And we've got interesting art coming out, like Cardi B, Wet Ass Pussy and stuff.
That lightens the mood during dark days,
yeah.
Right? So
that's right. Had to throw that out there, you know. Well, it's been a great hour. I appreciate you guys both taking the time to talk to us a little bit about creative nonfiction. And our guests today have been Sean Prentice and Jessica Henry Nelson. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Alan. Thank you, John. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much, you two. I really loved it.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh.
Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.